Welcome to the Best Science Medicine Podcast, BS without the BS.
Hi, everyone, and welcome to the 553rd episode of Best Science Medicine Podcast. My name is James McCormack, and I'm a professor with the Faculty of Pharmaceutical Sciences at the University of British Columbia.
I'm Mike Allen. I'm a family doctor and the director of practice support at the College of Family Physicians of Canada. I'm also an adjunct professor at the University of Alberta. But moving further east, James,
as we tend to like Alberta.
From Winnipeg, Jen, can you introduce yourself?
Hi, I'm Jen Potter. I'm a family doctor and an assistant professor in the Department of Family Medicine at the University of Manitoba.
And Jen, I don't know if you know this. I'm not sure this is good or bad thing. This is your fifth podcast with us.
Is it?
Yes, it is.
Oh. And by intention too, Jen.
Yes. So. Yeah. You didn't just like get in on the Zoom. Yeah, I didn't just get in on the Zoom call type of thing.
I didn't just walk in the wrong door or something.
Yeah.
That's right. Yeah. And get stuck doing a podcast with us.
And so you've done five of this. This is the third of a particular topic. And we're going to be talking about heavy menstrual bleeding. And we have done a couple of podcasts on this topic, talking about different treatments though, right, Jen?
That's right. This is the third one. The first one we did was NSAIDs for heavy menstrual bleeding, and then we did the levonorgestrel IUD, and now we're on to tranexamic acid.
And this will be it, right? There's not going to be the fourth.
I think we're running out of options.
Okay, good. So what was the question you guys were looking
at? Is that a good that we're running out of options, James, or that we've completed the series?
Yeah, it's so difficult to know.
I think it's because we've completed the series, and I think it has been comprehensive, Jen. It's been, you've gone through a lot of different potential interventions for this common problem.
So, Jen, what was the question you guys were looking at?
So we were looking at for premenopausal women with heavy menstrual bleeding for benign reasons, so not uric cancers and other alarming etiologies, but for most people, does tranexamic acid improve outcomes?
And so, as always, you did a systematic group. You looked at as much information as you could find. And what did you guys find?
Well, we found one particular systematic review. It was a Cochrane review. And there was actually another Cochrane review that sort of had this topic as a part of it. It was a network meta-analysis. But we looked at, we focused on the one systematic review done by the Cochrane group. And that was done in 2018.
Right.
And what did they find in there versus, like, let's start with versus placebo.
So versus placebo, they found four RCTs, and they varied in size up to 300 patients. They looked at objective blood loss, so objectively measured blood loss per cycle, and they found that blood loss was reduced by 53 milliliters per cycle compared to with TXA compared to placebo. There was some variation in baseline blood loss, but when you consider that heavy menstrual bleeding is usually defined as 80 milliliters per cycle, I mean that's a pretty good number.
Mm-hmm.
And then we found that, we know that most patients, their experience doesn't necessarily line up with the objective measurement. So we wanted to also look at some other outcomes that were a little bit more patient-oriented. So when we looked at clinically detectable blood loss, so usually using like various rating scales and that kind of thing, we found that 39% of patients on tranexamic acid benefited versus 11% on placebo. So an absolute risk reduction of 28%.
Which is big. Like that's a number you need to treat a four. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly. They also used fewer sanitary items per cycle, around 24 versus around 30 on placebo. And there weren't really any increase in adverse events in those studies either.
So I found that interesting because one of the first studies I read on management of different, but was mainly heavy menstrual bleeding, but different menstrual disorders. Anyhow, they were talking about the study was talking about the use of sanitary napkins. And what it did is it correlated the amount of blood they could find on the product as well as the number itself of the products used. And what they found is that some people, so to just use the sanitary products alone, you really, it's like you say, you know, these things, they're very subjective. So some people were changing it after only a couple mils of blood, and others were changing it after a much higher volume. And so some people were using 30 in a day and some people were using 2. And so and then I thought, you know, is this particular to this condition? Because I was very early in reading research, and I then happened to read something on the feeling of hypoglycemia, and people were reporting it anywhere, feeling hypoglycemic anywhere from 2 to 15 of their sugar levels. So it just goes to show you that that's why you guys did such a great job with this. You did so many different ways of looking at the same data, so we can see kind of a consistency through the data, rather than just using kind of one endpoint.
Yeah, they definitely all used a lot of different endpoints, and they did use different rating scales, and they used different measures, and in some ways it was a bit challenging because of, you know, there was so much variability. But on the other hand, it does, like you say, give you a lot of different ways of looking at the problem.
Yeah, and they're all showing a similar thing, right? That's what's so reassuring. Yeah, there's you know, a lot of different ways to look at this, but all are showing a consistent pattern here, which is reassuring.
Yeah, that's what we thought.
And it's good. And it's good that they didn't find any difference in adverse effects, although it's, you know, it's a small number of people, and you wouldn't pick up sort of the rare adverse events. And we'll talk about those in a little bit. And I think, correct me if I'm wrong, but the quality of life wasn't any different.
Quality of life wasn't different. The duration of bleeding wasn't different.
Yeah.
So yeah, I mean, not everything was improved, but of all the things that there was a difference, they were all in favor of tranexamic acid.
Yeah. And that's all compared to placebo.
That's compared to placebo. Yeah.
Yeah. Now there are some comparative trials, though, right?
Yeah. Cause certainly there, we do have options. And so in the systematic review, they also did look at some of these treatment options head to head. The first one we looked at was oral progestins. There were 6 RCTs with up to 128 patients in them. Again, looking at starting with the objective blood loss, objectively measured blood loss, there wasn't a difference between the two groups, between the progestin group and between the tranexamic acid group. But the patients, you know, in terms of their clinical perception of it, 71% with tranexamic acid benefited versus 46% with progestins. And again, this time they did notice a difference in bleeding duration, which was slightly better with tranexamic acid compared to progestins, although it's not a big difference. And they also, in this one, they looked at flooding, which they didn't really report as, you know, with any kind of definition, but they did report that more people found that flooding got better with tranexamic acid rather than progestins as well. So again, different measures, different outcomes. And despite the fact that there was no objective difference, some of the more subjective items people did find were better.
Yeah. So in this case, there was no difference between the use of sanitary items.
Not in this one.
Yeah.
But there was actually in this one a difference in the adverse events, which were better. 21% of patients had some kind of adverse event versus 32% on the progestin group. So they were also a little bit better tolerated.
Right. Yeah. So about a 10% absolute difference in the chance of developing, and those adverse effects were just headaches and spotting and things like that.
Yeah. Yeah. There was a big variety, but yeah, they were generally not, they didn't report on, you know, how many people stopped the trial or anything like that.
So in this case, I think we would go with the TXA versus progestins.
Yeah, that would be my choice, I think. Yeah,
yeah, no, for sure. And then there's a couple more comparisons.
Yeah. The next one I'm going to talk about is the mefenamic acid, which is an NSAID. Mm-hmm. That was one RCT, and it had 49 patients in it. The objectively measured blood loss was reduced more from 164 to 75 with TXA compared to 186 down to 148 with mefenamic acid. So they did start kind of at somewhat different baselines, but it was quite a difference in reduction. But again, patients don't necessarily care about that. When we looked at the more subjective, clinically detectable blood loss, 87% with TXA reported improvement compared to 61% with mefenamic acid. And there wasn't really a difference between the two groups in the other outcomes we talked about. So things like bleeding duration and number of sanitary items.
So again, looks like TXA, you would choose it, at least from efficacy or tolerability, over mefenamic acid.
I would.
Yeah. This is just one RCT with 49 patients, but you know, that's the best evidence.
Yeah, with that limitation for sure.
Yeah. Yeah. And you said there are other meta-analyses as well.
Well, the other meta-analysis that was in the systematic review was the levonorgestrel IUD.
Right.
And that had one RCT and it was 42 patients. So again, pretty small. Mm-hmm. But that one, in contrast to the others, which showed TXA being more efficacious, in this one, the IUD was really, really more effective, where 61% of patients noticed improvement versus 29% with TXA. But again, no difference in quality of life or adverse effects between the two groups.
And similar, just one RCT with 42 patients, as you said. So it's tricky to, you know, really hang your hat on which of these is better. But, you know, all we can do is just show what the best available evidence is.
Yeah, exactly.
And it's surprising, though, when you think about it, because like most of us would advocate for IUDs for this problem, or we would certainly put it high on the list in the effectiveness. You've looked at that before, Jen, and to only have one study of 40 patients, it's a bit surprising.
I mean, that's a 42 patients in this particular, for these particular comparators, but it is, it's not a lot.
No. But I mean, if I remember correctly, there were NSAID studies where they were 5 people randomized. You'd remember better than me, but
there was one with 4. Yeah. With 4 people. So, you know,
20% less than what I thought.
Yeah. Yeah. It's, this is better.
Yeah. And I think, you know, Jessica said it best, you know, this is an incredibly common condition that can affect up to 50% of the population. And it's not well researched compared to something like vitamin D or, you know, a dozen other things and yet it's such a common condition. And we don't have great research in it. It really does speak volumes about some underlying problems.
Yeah, I really think it does.
And you guys came up with some basic limitations. I mean, part of it is that the trials are small, but you know, there's also a few other limitations as well.
Yeah. So, I mean, none of these are long-term studies. One of these trials was actually only 2 cycles long, and most of them were either 3 cycles or 6 cycles. So, we're not talking about years of testing or anything with anything here. The various outcomes that were measured, the various instruments that they used to measure things were really inconsistent. Some of the studies included people with fibroids, some of the studies did not. And then there were a couple of studies, or there were some studies that actually didn't include all of their patients. They didn't really do an ITT analysis. They did more of a per protocol analysis, which is never really what you want to see.
Yeah, Jen, for sure. The per protocol, obviously, it's at a risk of selecting a certain type of patients in there that meet their criteria, follow their criteria, what have you. But the other thing that's interesting here is, as you say, like what's happening in small trials is always, it can happen in any trial where they kind of pick the outcomes as their primary outcome. And there are advantages, as we went over earlier, about how it's kind of, you can see subjective outcomes are improved, objective outcomes, and you get a real picture from having all these different outcomes, but you also get a fear that They've selected ones that work. And then within trials, because we're seeing small trials, you always wonder, are there negative trials that we're not seeing that are small? It's less common to hide a big trial, but it's more common to hide small trials. So these that all percolates into any evidence like this. It's not just, you know, for heavy menstrual bleeding or TXA. It's that this is common in all small trials. Like right now I'm reviewing ketamine, and it's mostly small trials, kind of, you know, 20 people or so. And so those are trials that if they don't show what you want, you can not publish them. And that happens a lot. It's people think it's related to industry, but it's actually just researchers not wanting to publish things that are what we would quote unquote call negative.
Yeah, no, I think you're exactly right. And having been on that side, you kind of go, oh, it didn't show anything. And then you lose interest in the people you worked with don't want to do it either. And it's...
Yeah, for sure. They've lost interest. And it's just, yeah, it's not, and you always think it's like, to harken back to a great Canadian group, to the Tragically Hip, they're one of their famous lines is, no one cares about something you didn't do.
Yeah.
And so it's that feeling among us, right? That if it's negative, no one will really care.
Yeah.
And as a result, we get bias creeps into the literature, not always with sinister intent, although sometimes there is an intention to hide things that don't verify your belief. But a lot of the time, it's just as you said, James, we kind of lose interest in it, or we don't think people will care. But it's a big deal getting something published. You have to navigate. There's a lot of paperwork and navigation. And you're thinking, just, you know, to get this small negative, and I'm putting negative in quotes here, negative study published, it's not worth it for me. That's what a lot of us
and you know, and you're exactly right, Mike. And we it's possible in this area. It's definitely been seen in psychiatry. But fascinatingly enough, it really hasn't been seen exactly as you said, like with a very, very large cardiovascular trials. I've never heard of one not being published. So that's the nuance, right?
It's big trials generally get published because there's so many people invested in them and so much went into them. And there is research now showing that it's journals. The journals are not, the original accusation was against journals. And it turns out the journals are probably not responsible for the majority of this. It's actually off.
And the one sort of thing that I like hanging my head on is that with those large trials, as you know, a bunch of them were negative. They actually weren't just neutral; they were negative, and they get published. So it's you know, you can't just there's no life is complicated.
Yeah, and it's not just industry at blame here. There's a lot of things. But we're drifting from our topic.
Yeah, we will. And so there's an important context, I think, and we'll get to that in just a second, because I think it's important to remember that TXA is not a hormone or anything like that. It doesn't, you know, it doesn't treat any of the symptoms, premenstrual symptoms. You know, it's not an effective form of birth control and doesn't stop your period and all those sorts of things. So you would use it quite differently, right, Jen?
Yeah. So it's an antifibrinolytic is the category that it's in.
Mm-hmm.
And so basically, with anything that's antifibrinolytic, you might get concerned about clots.
Mm-hmm.
And none of these studies that we've been talking about were anywhere near powered enough to show a difference in you know, clotting events. None of them, there were no events in any of these trials, but you know, they're really quite underpowered for that. So the general rule of thumb is that we would probably not prescribe these for people who, you know, have a clotting disorder, or who've had a, you know, a history of blood clots in the past. But you know, that's sort of more based not so much on these trials, but really more on general, you know, general knowledge of these medications.
Yeah, because we've actually done podcasts on stuff with trauma and large bleeds and all that sort of stuff. And you can correct me if I'm wrong, Mike, I don't think they showed a problem with thromboembolic events.
Well, I'm not going to correct you, James. Not that you're not wrong. It's just I can't remember.
Yeah, no, I don't think. Yeah. And
I would love to correct you if you're wrong.
I know. I know. Yeah. I know.
You know, I'd love to get in there.
Yeah.
No, I'm kidding. I actually can't recall. Sorry.
Yeah, yeah. And I think obviously this is not, you don't take this all, you know, this is not a daily thing. You take it just and I think Jen, earlier, you not in the podcast, we talked about it's about 5 days, right?
Yeah, the studies basically most of them use the medication for 5 days, usually at a dose of about a gram QID for 5 days, starting with the first day of bleeding is usually how it's used.
Yeah, and so I guess anyone who, you know, doesn't want to use an IUD or doesn't want hormones, or maybe didn't find that NSAID type products were useful, this might be the way to go.
Yeah, exactly. It's always nice to have more tools in your toolkit rather than less. So
yeah.
So it's a good one. It's a good one to have there.
Yeah. And I mean, it's not. Go ahead, Mike.
Too expensive. I was just gonna say It's not too expensive. I think you were gonna go.
No.
There anyway.
Yeah.
$14, I think, a cycle is what you have. So that's pretty.
Yeah, and if you compare that to, you know, say an oral contraceptive per cycle, yeah, I mean it's probably a better option in most cases from a mm-hmm. cost perspective.
Excellent. So I think we've done this topic as best we can. I don't know if we can go in any more detail, but it's certainly, you now, if you go back in time, you can find out, you know, what's the evidence for using NSAIDs, using hormones to impact menstrual blood loss in a variety of different forms. And now we have this last one, TXA. So now you know as much as I think anybody knows. So anything else you want to add?
There's one other person who knows this much, and that's the co-author.
Yes. Oh, of course. Yes, yes.
Yeah, we should mention Jennifer Young co-authored this with you, with Jen. And so it was the Jen squared.
Mm-hmm.
That was it. That was
not that you're squares. Not that you're squares. But you are nerds. You work in the peer team. So you, let's be honest.
Yeah,
you know, gotta wear that badge proudly.
Exactly. We all do.
Good for you. Anything else, Mike, you want to bring up?
No, that is good, James. Thanks for going over all this.
Although we probably should mention the guideline.
We should, and we will be mentioning it in a series of podcasts coming up. We're doing we just recently published the updated, simplified lipid guideline and cardiovascular risk reduction, and that is published in Canadian Family Physician. Everyone on this podcast was involved, and led by Mike Kolber and Adrian Lindblad, who has obviously been in the team a long time, both of them. No reference to their age.
No.
And James, you and Ricky and others worked on the online risk assessment tool.
We did.
And
yeah.
Decision.
And so it's all there for people to go look at. So we'd encourage you guys to go look at it. And like you said, we're going to talk about this probably in a few podcasts later on. Once we get through a few other ones, and I think it's worth having a look. It was what, probably a year and 2 years of work, Mike, I think.
A year and a half year plus in the making.
Yeah,
for
yeah.
Sure.
So yeah, go check it out. I think it's. I think you'll find it simplified, and there's a lot of useful tips and suggestions you can take from that. Do you want to talk about anything to do with CFPC Learn?
Well, we have CFPC Learn available as part of. So if you got your tools for practice, you would have seen a reference mm-hmm. to getting certified credits for that, and you do that through CFPC Learn. And you can get them with the podcast as well. So if you listen to the podcast and are on CFPC Learn, you can get a half a credit for that, and even a quarter credit for the tools for practice itself. So it's a nifty little program that can help you accumulate credits and stay up to date.
Perfect. So I think we'll just leave it at that. So thanks as always for listening.
Talk to you later.